The reason I asked you to read this article by Hick, John Hick, was because it lays out in a sort of philosophical and analytic sense the theory behind doing the study of religion that I have organized for this class. And he lays out how to look at the pluralistic problem in a way which is very different than Diana Eck does, very different than the Dalai Lama does, and very different than Ramakrishna does, or any of his followers who I've identified as exponents of the perennial philosophy. His explanation is the most systematically radical from begin, excuse me, systematically rational, big difference, from beginning to end. And it's an intellectual activity which, as such, can make sense, I think, to pretty much anybody. So I wanted to work through that, and it's one of the reasons we're going to almost paragraph by paragraph work through this text. Not actually, but key points work through this text. And what I'll do is I will reference page numbers in the text and paragraphs so that you can follow me on your own copy. And sometimes what I'll do is I'll ask you to read that paragraph before I talk about it, or sometimes I just read a line in it and then we'll talk about it. And we'll see how that goes. I mean, this isn't typically the way I teach, but this particular essay deserves really close attention. So we're gonna try this and we'll see how it goes. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but maybe it'll work. So for starters, if we go to page 608 in the text, one of the things that you'll notice is that Hick references Wilfred Cantwell Smith, as did Diana Eck, who was a very important philosopher of religious studies at Harvard. So there's a way in which they're sort of in a similar school of thought, but things end quite differently. If we go to the second full paragraph on page 608, which begins, "The way of seeing the religious life of humanity as organized in a number of communities based on rival sets of religious beliefs." Here's the key sentence in this paragraph from the point of view of what I want to talk about. "Looking at the religions of the world, then, in the plural, we are presented with competing aims to possess the saving truth. For each community believes that its own gospel is true, and that other gospels are false insofar as they differ from it." So this is, as I've said ad nauseum in this class, the key problem in doing any kind of comparative religious studies. Because there are certain conclusions that one draws from this fact. If you're living a religious life, say you're a Muslim or a Christian, and this is your view, and this is the typical view of people of any major religion, then you can't but come to a conclusion that everybody else is wrong. And that leads to certain problems. I mean, if you're a basically rational person, and you look at that, you have to realize, how is it possible that one corner of the world has an edge on truth, and the rest of the world doesn't? Now, in ancient days, when people were pretty much more isolated from each other, that wasn't such an issue, really. You know, I mean, for example, if we go to Arabia at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, most people in Arabia, say in Mecca or Medina, didn't have much contact with the rest of the world. Now, Muhammad did, in fact, because he was involved in the caravan trade, and you couldn't really call him urbane in the sense of knowing lots of cultures firsthand in the way you would, say, if you lived in a very complex city like the Rome of his time. But he knew about all kinds of other religions, and that actually is very relevant if you study Islam and you try and figure out where did everything come from in his own revelation. You can sort of see influences from other religions, although Muslims don't generally like to acknowledge that that's the case, but you can see those things. But for the people of Mecca, basically all they knew was what we would call animism or polytheism, all this multiplicity of gods, small g, and then there's this new teaching about God, capital G, who subsumes everything else. And it was one thing or another. And that's pretty much the way it is with most religions. But in the modern world, we know that that idea is not going to hold. All right, so in this sentence, Hicks sets up the problem. Now then, if we jump over to page 609, and the second full paragraph down, and what I mean by full paragraph is any paragraph that begins with an indentation. This paragraph begins, "These cumulative traditions." He defines the idea of tradition, and this is a very interesting concept that's entered religious studies. It's actually borrowed from anthropology and then kind of modified. "Each tradition creates human beings in its own image, for we are not human in general, participating in an eternal platonic essence of humanity. We are human in one way or other of the various concrete ways of being human, which constitute the cultures of the earth." Now, this would seem straightforward and simple, but the point that he's going to develop here is that the idea of religiousness or the idea of truth is not something that exists just in the abstract out there. In fact, it only exists embodied in human beings or in the collective activity of human beings of what we call culture. And that there's a mutual interaction between these two things. So let me be very specific about what this means. I'll give you an example. It's one of my favorite examples, actually. If you look at, I'm holding my hand up for those that are listening to this recording. I'm holding my hand up with my arms sort of right angles above myself. Okay. When I say hand, you see this area from the wrist to the fingertips. That's pretty straightforward. That's literally what you see when I say the word hand. And if I say forearm, you see the space between my wrist and my elbow. That's pretty specific also. That's because you're an American and you speak American English. If you were a Tibetan, there is a word for hand, and it includes the region from the fingertip down to the elbow. It's not hand, and it's not forearm. It's another word, but it includes all of that. Okay. When Tibetans look at a body, they don't see this joint, which we call a wrist, in the same way as we see the joint we call a wrist. We see the joint called a wrist because we understand it's the margin between the hand and the forearm. Immediately, that's because that's what our language predisposes us to do. For Tibetans, you have to do something additional in your thinking to get to the point of recognizing that a wrist is not just a juncture, or that a wrist is a juncture between these two parts of the body. You see it. It's not like they don't know what a wrist is and what a wrist does. They do. But they have to take an extra step to look at it. Similarly, I don't ski, so I go outside in the wintertime and I look at snow and I just see cold white wet stuff or cold white dry stuff. That's pretty much the extent of it. It's either thicker or thinner. That's it. I mean, it's either deeper or less deep. And when I see that, that means something to me, as in how much shoveling do I have to do and how cold am I going to be when I do it. And that's it. That's my relationship with snow. So a friend of mine has been skiing all his life. That's not what he sees when he walks outside. He walks outside and there's new snow, and he thinks immediately of what is going on in the mountains around us here. What's happening up at Anthony? What kind of snow is up there? And when he gets there, he sees stuff that I can't even see. He has names for all kinds of snow, and he sees those things, and he sees them as being different than what I see. So you've studied perception in a psychology class, and this is perhaps something you already know, but I'm using this to make a point, which is that what we literally see and understand depends upon the culture and the language in which we develop, in which we grow. It's not just a given that everybody sees everything in the same way. Similarly, everybody doesn't understand everything in the same way. It depends upon the cultural environment out of which they come. In religious studies, these things are usually referred to as traditions, because we're looking at a way of understanding a religious culture. And tradition is sort of a shorthand for referring to that. So in the United States, you would talk about the Judeo-Christian tradition, because in truth, the interweaving of Judaism and Christianity and the many versions of both of those over thousands of years has produced our current religious culture. And in fact, you probably want to add to it things like the Enlightenment tradition in the West and a lot of other factors, which are all mixed up together because they've sort of intertwined with each other. It's not an accident that you have religious symbols on American money and religious statements on American money, such as "In God We Trust." Okay, in a Buddhist world like China, where they had paper money, you would not find the words "In God We Trust," right? Because they didn't have a creator God who subsumed everything in which they could trust. Now, they might have said "In Heaven We Trust," or "In the Emperor We Trust," although it's unlikely they would have said that. They might have, but they wouldn't say "In God We Trust," because it's not the way they, in their tradition, relate to what's going on around them. So, why does this matter? It matters because religious experience, whether it's exoteric or esoteric, always happens in the context of something specific. It doesn't happen in the abstract. It happens to a person who lives in a culture. Okay, and so this is the point that Hick is making. Each tradition creates human beings in its own image. So we're not totally open and free in the way we understand and perceive things. Now, as a consequence of bringing these things together, if we jump to page 610, to the first full, actually the second full, well, first and second full paragraph, the editor says, "We omit Hick's discussion of the relation between the realities labeled exclusivism." Then Hick says, "However, we may now turn to a second Christian answer to our question, which can be labeled inclusivism." Now, at this point, I don't want to talk specifically about Christian theology, but I want to talk about the ideas of exclusivism and inclusivism, because we're going to find these later on. For example, there is an article that you'll be reading in which the Dalai Lama is talking about inclusivism, or at least that's the label that's given to it. I don't think he uses that word. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, in the Christian tradition specifically, there is this idea that Christ is, although the Bible says the Son of Man, interpreted as God incarnate. I mean, in the Gospels, Christ doesn't exactly say that ever. He doesn't say, "I'm God." He says things that can be seen as referring to that. And later theologians, in fact, do talk about this. And this is very important in Christianity, because the idea is that God has incarnated, to use that word, in the form of Jesus. And in Christianity, God has only incarnated once in the form of Jesus. Now, if God has incarnated in the form of Jesus, and God has spoken about what's required to be saved, to go to heaven, to know the absolute truth, or in fact how to be in relationship to your neighbors, your compatriots, your village, your community, if God has spoken about these things, A, you better believe it, because it's God who said it, who speaks the truth. Okay. But B, what does this mean for all those other people who are outside and have maybe not heard this? It could mean you need to tell them. It could mean if you tell them and they don't believe you, there's a problem. It could mean maybe you don't care. It could mean all kinds of different things. But the terms inclusivism and exclusivism, as used in religious studies, refer to the conclusion you come to. If the conclusion you come to is you got it right and every other tradition has it wrong, that's exclusivism. you have excluded them from the reality that you're experiencing. But if you come to the conclusion of inclusivism, right, it means something quite different. And what would inclusivism mean in the context of Christianity? Now, Hick deals with that because he wants to get to this place of having Christianity to be an embracing religious tradition, which allows other religious traditions to be unique and independent. We'll come back to that later. It's not really what I want to talk about right now. I want to talk about his general argument, not specifically as it relates to Christianity, although it comes out of that because he is a Christian theologian. Okay, so then we go on to what is the third possible answer. So if we go down to paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, which starts the third possible answer to the question of the relation between salvation or liberation and the cumulative religious traditions can best be called pluralism, a word which I've been harping on in this class. If we accept that salvation slash liberation is taking place within all the great religious traditions, now we're going to have to go back to why he comes to this conclusion. If we accept that salvation liberation is taking place within all the great religious traditions, why not frankly acknowledge that there is a plurality of saving human responses to the ultimate divine reality? Pluralism, then, is the view that the transformation of human existence from self-centeredness to reality-centeredness, and this is capital R, that's like saying God-centeredness, is taking place in different ways within the contexts of all the great religious traditions. There is not merely one way, but a plurality of ways of salvation or liberation. This is the key point, and this is his definition of pluralism. I'll repeat it. Pluralism, then, is the view that the transformation of human existence from self-centeredness to reality-centeredness is taking place in different ways within the context of all the great religious traditions. There is not merely one way, but a plurality of ways of salvation or liberation. Now, how does he come to that conclusion? We're going to explore this. But let me give you a sort of gloss on it or a summary of it. If you're a rational person living in a complex culture, the kind of environment that Diana Eck has talked about, say in her native Cambridge slash Boston, where down the street you have Muslims and up the street you have Buddhists and across the street you have Hindus, and it's just this big mishmash of cultures, you might notice that all these different religious traditions are producing human beings who have good human values. That all the different religious traditions are saying, be good to your neighbors, be nice to your neighbors. For example, the golden rule in Christianity is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Confucius said, don't do anything to anybody you wouldn't have them do to you. Now, it's obviously very different, but it's obviously also the same. And we can be sure that Jesus didn't know anything about what Confucius had to say, and we can be even more sure that Confucius had no idea what Jesus had to say, right? Because Confucius lived before Jesus, besides the fact they lived on opposite sides of the continent and couldn't speak each other's languages. Even if they were next to each other, they wouldn't have been able to communicate. Okay, so we look at all these different cultures, and we recognize that all these different cultures, or all these different religious traditions, to use the language we're using here, produce people who are ethically improved to the degree to which they're involved in that religious tradition. Hick goes a step farther. That would be Diana Eck's point of view. Hick goes a step farther. He says, if we look around, we also see that part of what religions do is that they put people in relationship to reality with a capital R, which we could call the ultimate, or we could call it God if you like that language. But God is not a tradition, is not an idea or an experience that exists in all religions, curiously. What Christians mean by God is not a concept that actually exists in Buddhism, for example. And although it looks like the concept of God is the same in Buddhism, excuse me, in Christianity and Hinduism, it turns out there's some significant differences. So, nevertheless, people who engage in these different religious traditions are personally changed in their relationship to that ultimate, however defined in those different traditions. They become different people. Hick refers to this as moving from ego-centeredness to reality-centeredness, and that's part of what religions do. Usually mystical religions do this, okay, because mystical religions are, or mystical aspects of religions are the aspects of religions that promote personal experience of the ultimate. Okay, so if you go to church on Sunday and it's, say it's Easter, and you sing and have a good time, and then you go out and chase Easter eggs around with your kids, and then that's your idea of religiousness, that might be fine, but that's not about having a personal relationship with God. It's about having a relationship with a community, which is a fine thing. Okay. But Hick is talking about something else. Okay. Now, if you're a rational person, you look around and you see, now isn't this interesting that we have Christian saints who talk about their relationship with God and their experience in God, and we have Muslim saints who do the same thing, and they might sound similar to each other, but then we have Buddhist saints, and they don't sound similar to Christian saints. But there are interesting Buddhists out there who people are very interested in listening to. This morning, I was listening to a live web stream from Emory University in Atlanta. Dalai Lama was there. He is the presidential distinguished faculty member at Emory University. That's about the most highfalutin faculty position you can have there. And he was giving a lecture to people, and everybody was very interested in what he had to say. Right? He didn't say anything about God, even though he was introduced by the theology faculty. In fact, he was introduced by a Jewish theologian, who was introduced by the president of the university, naturally, who had to be up there to, you know, do his piece too. And people look at him and say, this is a very saintly person. Doesn't talk about God. In fact, he doesn't believe in the God that Christians believe in. But around the world, people look at him as a saintly figure. And he hangs out with people like Desmond Tutu, who does believe in God, and people look at as a relatively saintly figure, at least in a political sense. You know, so you look around and you see that all kinds of religions, all different religious traditions, produce extraordinary people who have direct experience of reality, the ultimate. Dalai Lama would talk about that anyway. Okay. But the realities and the ultimates are different, and yet here are all these extraordinary people. So rationally, the conclusion you have to draw, unless you're an exclusivist, if you're an inclusivist or a pluralist, rationally the conclusion you draw is, all religions are useful and good. But then that creates a new set of problems for you, doesn't it? Because yours isn't any better than anybody else's now, if you come to that conclusion. Okay, so that can be a very difficult conclusion for some people to come to, because that's discomforting. Because now you're faced with the problem of, I believe in my tradition, and I value my tradition, but I have to realize rationally that it's not any different in terms of its ultimate goodness than somebody else's tradition. That makes some people uncomfortable. Other people are not made uncomfortable by that. That is a matter of personality. It's not really a matter of religions. Okay. So, that's the reason why this statement is so important about the nature of pluralism, because you see this transformation going on, and it happens in all traditions. All right, now I'm going to read a longer passage on page 612. I better drink a little tea before I do this. And it's the first full paragraph on 612. Maybe before we go there, are there questions about what I... You know, I don't usually do this sort of thing, and so I'm kind of rumbling on, but I want to be sure that we're all good about what's happening. If you have questions, anything you want to talk about at this point, we could do it before I go on. It's okay? I'm sorry to see this, but there are a lot of plagues going around. So I've been, I've just been clear. That's it. That's why there are no questions. How nice. It happens sometimes. Maybe.
First full paragraph, second line. Stated philosophically, such a pluralism is the view that the great world faiths embody different perceptions and conceptions of and correspondingly different responses to the real or the ultimate from within the major variant cultural ways of being human. That's what I was just talking about. And that within each of them, the transformation of human existence from self-centeredness to reality-centeredness is manifestly taking place. And taking place, so far as human observation can tell, to much the same extent. Thus, the great religious traditions are to be regarded as alternative soteriological spaces, that means methods of salvation, soteriological spaces within which, or ways along which, men and women can find salvation slash liberation slash enlightenment slash fulfillment.
All those slashes are in there because he can't define what the ultimate goal is if he's being truly pluralistic, because liberation and salvation are not the same thing. Salvation in Christianity, liberation in Buddhism. Okay, so this is basically the point that I was making before reading this. Now, I may play for you that a recording of the Dalai Lama's talk to introduce that particular material, or I may not, because he's going to be doing another talk in a class at Emory tomorrow morning, and I'll be watching the webcast of that, and they meant that one may be better. But the reason I'm mentioning this is because when Hick talks about transformation of human existence from self-centeredness to reality-centeredness, this morning the Dalai Lama was saying, you know, the basic problem on this planet is that everybody is self-centered instead of other-centered. Now, he doesn't mean by that that you stop caring about yourself and your own situation. But what he does mean by that is that if you don't care about anybody else, and you don't have any empathy with anybody else, and if you don't have any empathy with anybody else, and you can't relate to anybody else, you're going to walk around being grumbling and unhappy and tend to be angry all the time, right? Because everybody else is an obstacle to you instead of an ally of you. That's a real simplistic way of putting it. But in this respect, Hick and the Dalai Lama turn out to be on the same page. In other respects, they're on very different pages, as we say. Okay. Now then, having come to this conclusion that in truth, if we take a clear-eyed sort of objective view of things, we have to recognize that all religions work to get people from ego-centeredness to other reality-centeredness. All religions work to transform people. Then the question arises, is anyone better than the other? How are they the same as each other? What are the ultimates that they're talking about? And so on and so forth. And this is where he comes back to this, or this is where he comes to the example that I used in yesterday's lecture about the blind man and the elephant. It's like, we can't really know all these other religious traditions very well, even though we see evidence that they work. We can't really know how they work. And why can't we know how they work? Because it's like, we're like the blind man and the elephant. We're touching the leg of the elephant. Somebody else is touching the trunk of the elephant, and they seem really different from each other. Even though they're both round, they're certainly very different from each other. How can we know this variety? The only way we can know the difference, when we're following this metaphor, is if we're standing outside and we're sighted, then we can look at the elephant. But Hick says that is not possible, except logically we can conclude things, but we can't directly experience them. We can't experience the trunk and the leg both. And the reason for that is because of the peculiarity of the way we are developed in our own culture. The person who grasps the trunk versus the person who grasps the leg are only grasping different parts of the elephant because they grew up in different traditions and different cultures. And therefore, instead of seeing a forearm and a hand, they see a hand or a forearm, or what,
you know, however the case may be, because of the way in which their perceptions are disposed because of the environment in which they grew, in which they develop the language that they have. So, because of that, Hicks says, there is no way to in any way compare, except logically we can deduce things, there's no way to directly, experientially compare these different traditions. It's not humanly possible. When we get to talking about Ramakrishna a little later, he is going to say Hick is 100% wrong. Now, Ramakrishna lived before Hick. They never knew each other, although Hick probably knew about Ramakrishna. Nevertheless, they're in utter disagreement about this very important point. That's the reason we're going to be studying Ramakrishna, in fact, because he has a lot to say about this issue, as do his followers. And they are people who could be categorized more or less as following what we would call the perennial philosophy. This is a concept that goes back to Leibniz in Western philosophical tradition, just for what it's worth. It's not a recent idea. It goes back pretty far. Okay. I'm going to read what he says about this. But where is the vantage point from which one can observe both the divine reality and the different limited human standpoints from which that reality is being variously perceived? That is to say, the elephant versus the leg or the trunk of the elephant. The advocate of the pluralist understanding cannot pretend to any such cosmic vision, although Ramakrishna claimed to have had that cosmic vision. How then does he profess to know that the situation is indeed as he depicts it? Which is to say, all the different traditions are good and get you to the same ultimate, however that ultimate is defined. The answer is that he does not profess to know this, and he italicizes the word know, he emphasizes it. If by knowledge we mean infallible cognition, nor indeed can anyone else properly claim to have knowledge in this sense of either the exclusivist or the inclusivist picture. All of them are, strictly speaking, hypotheses. The pluralist hypothesis is arrived at inductively. One starts from the fact that many human beings experience life in relation to a limitlessly greater transcendent reality, capital R. Whether the direction of transcendence be beyond our present existence or within its hidden depths. And the reason he makes this this distinction beyond our present existence or within its hidden depths is he's talking about the difference between traditions of God as immanent and God as transcendent. And I'll just make an aside here because he mentions this. Most Western traditions, certainly modern Western traditions, take the view God's up there in heaven and we're down here, and they're separate from each other. God and us are separate. So we might want to forge a relationship between them, but that's the best we can do. That's the transcendent notion of God. And in its most simplistic form, God is an old man with a long white beard, probably holding a book, sitting on a throne. The throne is sitting on a cloud. The clouds are up there in heaven someplace. And we're not there. But if we're good, maybe we'll get there after we die. Okay, that's transcendent view of religion, and I've certainly grossly simplified it, but it makes the point, I think. The immanent view of religion is usually associated with primal peoples like American Indians. So the Sioux, for example, Sioux Indians, for example, if you read, say, Black Elk Speaks, which is the testament of a Sioux, what we would call medicine man, or more properly a shaman, Black Elk speaks to the fact that he experiences the sacredness of the earth, which is to say, for him, God, the spirit, is in the ground he stands on, the deer he hunts, the sun that rises, the wind that blows, the food that he eats. Sacredness is within everything around him. That's the tradition of religion, which we call immanence. Scholars of religion sometimes refer to this as animism, that everything is alive. That's in a little bit of a derogatory
language, perhaps. But anyhow, it's the idea of immanence, that God is in everything. But if you look at the mystical traditions, say, of Christianity, you actually do find that many Christian mystics have arrived at that conclusion. God isn't just out there. God is right here. And in Islam, although generally speaking, we think of Islam as a religion that is oriented toward a transcendental notion of God or Allah, if we look in the Quran, we find statements like, Allah is closer to you than your jugular vein. That's a pretty concrete way of talking about immanence. What's closer to you than your jugular vein? Well, among other things, your jugular vein is the essence of life. It's in your neck. What's closer to you than the life that is flowing in your neck? That's what they're saying. So they're hinting at immanence. And in Islam, the reason that they do this is because they believe there's nothing apart from God. Now, that creates some interesting problems for them, which we're not going to get into in this class. But if there's nothing apart from God, because what could be other than God? Because God is everything, that means that God creates all kinds of interesting problems about good and evil, neighbors, enemies, friends, so on and so forth. Gets you to asking questions about what do they mean by jihad. It opens up all kinds of complex doors, to say the least. But it's the idea of immanence is there. Okay. That's a bit of an aside, but I wanted to go down that line anyway. One starts from the fact that many human beings experience life in relation to a limitless, greater, transcendent reality, whether the direction of transcendence be beyond our present existence or within its hidden depths. That's where I ended. Now, the question really is, where do we stand for this? Hick, I'm going to summarize it because this is where I'm going to end until tomorrow. And then I'm going to go on page 613 because I don't really have enough time today to finish the whole rest of the argument, and I want to do it in one piece. Hick has taken the position, to summarize, that for a rational person would see that all different religious traditions have value, that they move people from self-centeredness to reality-centeredness, however reality is defined. And reality is defined in many different ways in many traditions, so we're talking about capital R reality. Could be reality as a personal God, could be reality as an impersonal ground of existence, could be that reality is a God that exists within the world, could be that reality is a God that's outside of the world. There are all these different possibilities, and these are all pretty radically different possibilities for capital R reality, and they are excluded from each other. If God is in the world, he's not out of the world, and if he's out of the world, he's not in the world. Rationally, those are not both possible. If God is personal, like a person, or if God is the impersonal ground of existence, these are mutually exclusive, at least logically and rationally. So where does Hick leave us? He says we can't know if one of these things is true and the others are false. All we can do is deductively conclude they're all good, and in some way they're all real for religious people in those traditions. So if you're a Christian, personal God is real. If you're a Buddhist, impersonal ground of existence is real, even though they're utterly different from each other. And they're all equally real, and we can't know anything about the other one than the one we know. So if I'm a Buddhist, I can't really understand what Christians experience as God if they experience God. And if I'm a Christian, I can't really understand what Buddhists experience if they experience whatever the ultimate is in Buddhism. Turn it off, okay? Maybe that's your car being fixed. So the point, though, is if we think back on what Eck has suggested, she was making comments about people who have braided, modern braided religious experiences and traditions and the value of those things. She talked about the Jesuit, I think his name was, now I can't think of his name. Okay. She talked about the Jesuit who was practicing meditation as taught in the Hindu tradition, and that that was probably a good thing because it improved his own spiritual path, his own spiritual seeking. Hick would say, what's the point of doing this? Because the ultimate is not going to be the same in these two traditions. Although he might say, well, okay, well, maybe the mechanism of practicing meditation can support this tradition. So I'm not so sure about that. Maybe I've made an extreme statement here. Anyway, we see that Hick arrives at a different conclusion than Eck, and we'll find that Hick arrives at a different conclusion than Ramakrishna, and we'll find that Hick arrives at a different conclusion than the Dalai Lama. And so obviously I'm not saying anybody's right and anybody else is wrong. I'm saying from the point of view of studying religions, there are different conclusions that we can have and different approaches. In the second half of this class, the approach we're going to take is an approach that's essentially defined by the Dalai Lama, although I'm not doing it because he's defined it. The approach is, well, what about science? What about human nature? Is there something that we can know about human nature apart from all these issues of the ultimate that cut across all the different religious traditions that would help us understand religious experience in all those traditions because of our humanness? Now, the Dalai Lama talks about this, but the way he talks about it, as we will find, he talks about it as we can find a basis for ethics so that we can get along as 7 billion people on this little planet because of our own fundamental humanness and the biological realities of being human. And he says that's about it. Because from his point of view, he's like Hick. The ultimates in Buddhism and Christianity are different. He doesn't say that a Buddhist can't know the ultimate in Christianity. He just says it's different. It's definitely different. It is definitely not the same. Ramakrishna is going to tell us something different entirely. And that's why I'm belaboring this point. That's why we're studying all of them, because we cannot come down on one single position without being a type of cultural imperialist, right? If we come down on the Buddhist position, then essentially we're being Buddhist cultural imperialists imposing a point of view on, say, a Christian or a Muslim world. If we come down on the Christian position, as exemplified in Hick or, say, Eck, we're being another kind of cultural imperialist because we're imposing a view of reality on, say, the Buddhist world that the Buddhists wouldn't accept. So I'm making this point because this class does fulfill the DPD requirement. And this will be an issue that we'll be talking about on the essays to fulfill that requirement. How do we understand religious traditions in a way which does not impose a specific point of view on those traditions, in spite of the fact that Hick tells us we can't even do that, which is the interesting point. Hick tells us we can't be anything but a type of imperialist because of the limitations of our own mind. Not like we're nasty imperialists, but we're sort of imperialists by circumstance. So we'll have to deal with that problem. Okay? So I'm going to do one more of these type of talks, and then I promise I won't do any more of them. But I do want to talk about Hick. Well, I might do more of them, but not too many. Okay? That's good? All right. If you have questions, you know, formulate those questions and bring them tomorrow.